What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Hi, I'm Terry Schmidt, a registered dietitian and host of On Nutrition, a podcast from Mayo Clinic where we dig into the latest nutrition trends and research to help you understand what's health and what's hype. There's a lot of wild stuff out there, so we'll be keeping it science-based, research-informed, and practical. Mayo Clinic's On Nutrition, new episodes every other week, wherever you get your podcasts.
Chapter 10 of The Hampstead Mystery. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Reading by Lars Rolander. The Hampstead Mystery by John Watson and Arthur Rees. Chapter 10.
And so you had no luck, Rolf? Inspector Chippenfield, glancing up from his official desk in Scotland Yard, put this question in a tone of voice which suggested that the speaker had expected nothing better. "I've seen the heads of at least half a dozen likely Western shops," Rolf replied, "and they tell me there is nothing to indicate where the handkerchief was bought. The scrap of lace merely shows that it was torn off a good handkerchief, but there is nothing about it to show that the handkerchief was different in any marked way from the average filmy scrap of muslin and lace which every smart woman carries as a handkerchief. I thought so myself before I started to make inquiries."
"Well, Rolf, we must come at it another way," said the inspector. "Undoubtedly, there is a woman in the case, and it ought not to be impossible to locate her. Your theory, Rolf, is that the murder was committed by someone who broke into the place while Sir Horace was entertaining a lady friend, or waiting for the arrival of a lady he expected. Either the lady had not arrived, or had left the room temporarily when the burglar broke into the house. He had spotted the place some days before and ascertained that it was empty. And when he found that Sir Horace had returned alone, he decided to break in and, covering Sir Horace with a revolver, try to extort money from him. A riskier but more profitable game than burgling in an empty house, if it came off. With his revolver in his hand, he made his way up to the library. Sir Horace parleyed with him until he could reach his own revolver, and then got in the first shot but missed his man. The burglar shot him and then bolted. The lady heard the shots and, rushing in, found Sir Horace in his death agony. She was stooping over him with her handkerchief in her hand, and in his convulsive moments he caught hold of a corner of it and the handkerchief was torn. The lady left the place and, on arrival home, concocted the letter which was sent here, telling us that Sir Horace had been murdered. Is that it?"
"Yes," assented Rolf. "Of course, I don't lay it down that everything happened just as you've said, but that's my idea of the crime. It accounts for all the clues we've picked up, and that is something."
"It is an ingenious theory, and it does you credit," said the inspector, who had not forgotten that he had proposed to Rolfe that they should help one another to the extent of taking one another fully into each other's confidence for the purpose of getting ahead of Crewe. "But you have overlooked the fact that it is possible to account in another way for all the clues we have picked up. Suppose Sir Horace's return from Scotland was due to a message from a lady friend. Suppose the lady went to see him, accompanied by a friend whom Sir Horace did not like, a friend of whom Sir Horace was jealous. Suppose they asked for money, blackmail, and there was a quarrel in which Sir Horace was shot. Then we have your idea as to how the lady's handkerchief was torn. I agree with that in the main. The lady and her friend fled from the place. Later in the night the place is burgled by someone who has had his eye on it for some time, and on entering the library he is astounded to find the dead body of the owner. Suppose he went home and, on thinking things over, sent the letter to Scotland Yard with the idea that if the police got on to his tracks about the burglary, the fact that he had told us about the murder would show he had nothing to do with killing Sir Horace. "That is a good theory too," said Rolfe in a meditative tone. "And the only person who can tell us which is the right one is Sir Horace's lady friend. The problem is to find her."
"Right," said the inspector approvingly. "And while you have been making inquiries at the shops about the handkerchief, I have been down to the Law Courts branch of the Equity Bank where Sir Horace kept his account. It occurred to me that a look at Sir Horace's account might help us. You know the sort of man he was, you know his weakness for the ladies. But he was careful. I looked through his private papers out at Riversbrook, expecting to get on the track of something that would show someone had been trying to blackmail him over an entanglement with a woman. But I found nothing. I couldn't even find any feminine correspondence. If Sir Horace was in the habit of getting letters from ladies, he was also in the habit of destroying them. No doubt he adopted that precaution when his wife was alive, and found it such a wise one that he kept it up when there was less need for it. But a weakness for the ladies costs money, Rolfe, as you know, and that is why I had a look at his banking account. He made some payments that it would be worthwhile to trace, payments to Weston Drapers and that sort of thing. Of course, Sir Horace, being a cautious man and occupying a public position, might not care to flaunt his weakness in the eyes of Weston shopkeepers, and instead of paying the accounts of his lady friend of the moment, may have given her the money and trusted to her paying the bills. A thing that women of that kind are never in a hurry to do. In that case, the payments to Weston shopkeepers are for goods supplied to his daughter. However, I've taken a note of the names, dates and amounts of a number of them, and I want you to see the managers of these shops."
"We are getting close to it now," said Rolfe approvingly.
"I think so," was the modest reply of his superior. "There is one thing about Sir Horace's account which struck me as peculiar. Every 4 weeks for the past 8 months, Sir Horace drew a cheque for £24, and every cheque of the kind was made payable to number 365. Now, unless he wished to hide the nature of the transaction from his bankers, why not put in the cheque in the name of the person who received the money? It couldn't have been for his personal use, for in that case he would have made the cheque payable to self. Besides, a man with a banking account doesn't draw a regular £24 every 4 weeks for personal expenses. He draws a cheque just when he wants a few pounds, instead of carrying 5-pound notes about with him.
I asked the bank manager about these checks, and he looked up a couple of them and found they had been cashed over the counter. So he called up the cashier, and from him I learned that Sir Horace came in and cashed them. As far as he can remember, Sir Horace cashed all these £24 checks. I assume he did so because he realised that there was less likely to be comment in the bank than if a well-dressed, good-looking young lady arrived at the bank with them. This £24 a month suggests that Sir Horace had something choice and not too expensive stowed away in a flat. That is a matter on which Hill ought to be able to throw some light. If he knows anything, I'll get it out of him. It struck me as extraordinary that Sir Horace should have taken Hill into his service knowing what he was. But this apparently is the explanation. He knew that Hill wouldn't gossip about him for fear of being exposed, for that would mean that Hill would lose his situation and would find it impossible to get another one without a reference from him. We'll have Hill brought here. There was a knock at the door, and a boy in buttons entered and handed Inspector Chippenfield a card. "Seldon from Hampstead," he explained to Rolfe. "Don't go away yet. It may be something about this case." Police Inspector Seldon entered the office and held the door ajar for a man behind him. He shook hands with Inspector Chippenfield and Rolfe and then motioned his companion to a chair.
"This is Mr. Robert Evans, the landlord of the Flower Dew Hotel, Covent Garden," he explained.
He looked at Mr. Evans with the air of a police court inspector waiting for a witness to corroborate his statement, but as that gentleman remained silent, he sharply asked,
"Isn't that so?"
"Quite right," said Mr. Evans in a moist, husky voice. He was a short, fat man with an extremely red face and bulging eyes, which wanted very much and apparently required to be constantly mopped with a handkerchief which he carried in his hand. This peculiarity gave Mr. Evans the appearance of a man perpetually in mourning, and this effect was heightened by a species of incipient palsy which had seized on his lower facial muscles and caused his lips to tremble violently. He was bald in the front of the head, but not on the top. The baldness over the temples had joined hands and left isolated over the centre of the forehead a small tuft of hair, which, with the playfulness of second childhood, showed a tendency to curl.
"Yes, you're quite right," he repeated huskily, as though someone had doubted the statement. "Evans is my name, and I'm not ashamed of it."
"He came to me this morning and told me that Hill gave false evidence at the inquest yesterday," Inspector Seldon explained, "so I brought him along to see you."
"False evidence? Hill?" exclaimed Inspector Chippenfield with keen interest. "Let us hear about it."
"Well, you will remember Hill said he was at home on the night of the murder," pursued Inspector Seldon. "I looked up his depositions before I came away, and what he said was this. I took my daughter to the zoo in the afternoon. We left the zoo at 5:30 and went home and had tea. My wife then took the child to the picture palace, and I remained at home. I did not go out that night. They returned about 10:30, and after supper we all went to bed. But Evans tells me he saw Hill in his bar at 3:00 on the morning of the 19th of August. He has an early license for the accommodation of the Covent Garden traffic. He can swear to Hill. A man who goes to bed at 10:30 has no right to be wandering about Covent Garden at 3 a.m. And besides, Hill told us nothing about this. So I brought Evans along to see what you make of it." Inspector Chippenfield had taken up a pencil and was making a few notes.
"Very interesting indeed," he said. Then he turned to Evans and asked, "Are you sure you saw Hill in your bar at 3 a.m? There is no possibility of a mistake?"
"He's the man who was knocked down outside by a porter running into him," said Mr. Evans, mopping his eyes. I could bring half a dozen witnesses who will swear to him."
"You see, it's this way," interpolated Inspector Seldon, taking up the landlord's narrative. His police court training had taught him to bring out the salient points of a story, and he was naturally of the opinion that he could tell another man's story better than the man could tell it himself. Hill was staring about him. It was probably the first time he had been to Covent Garden in the early morning and got knocked over. He was stunned, and some porters took him into the bar, sat him on a form and poured some rum into him. Some of the porters were for ringing up the ambulance, others were for carrying Hill off to the hospital, but he soon recovered. However, he sat there for about 20 minutes, and after having several drinks at his own expense, he went away. Evans served him with the drinks. "Good," said Inspector Chippenfield, who liked the circumstantial details of the story. "And you can get half a dozen porters to identify him?"
"Bill Cribb, Harry Winch, Charlie Brown, a fellow they call Green Violets. I don't know his real name."
Mr. Evans was calling on his memory for further names, but was stopped by Inspector Chippenfield.
"Oh, that will do very well. And how did you happen to be at the inquest at Hampstead? That is a bit out of your way."
Mr. Evans mopped his eyes, and Inspector Seldon took upon himself to reply for him.
"He has a brother-in-law in the trade at Hampstead. Keeps the Three Jugs in Coulter Street. Evans had to go out to see his brother-in-law on business, and his brother-in-law took him along to the court out of curiosity."
Inspector Chippenfield nodded.
"Rolfe," he said, "take down Mr. Evans's statement outside and get him to sign it. Don't go away when you've finished. I want you."
Mr. Evans, even if he felt that full justice had been done to his story by Inspector Seldon, was disappointed at the police officer's failure to do justice to his many scruples in coming forward to give evidence against a man who had never done him any harm. Addressing Inspector Chippenfield, he said,
"I don't altogether like mixing myself up in this business. That isn't my way. If I have a thing to say to a man, I like to say it to his face. I don't like a man to say things behind a man's back, that is, if he calls himself a man. But I thought over this thing after leaving the court and hearing this chap Hill say he hadn't left home that night, and I talked it over with my wife."
"You did the right thing," said Inspector Chippenfield, with the emphasis of a man who had profited by the triumph of right. Mr. Evans was under the impression that the inspector's approval referred chiefly to the part he had played as a husband in talking over his perplexity with his wife, rather than the part he had played as a man in revealing that Hill had lied in his evidence.
"I always do," he said. "My wife's one of the sensible sort, and when a man takes her advice, he don't go far wrong. She advised me to go straight to the police station and tell them all I know. It's a cruel murder," she said, "and who knows but it might be our turn next."
This example of the imaginative element in feminine logic made no impression on the practical official who listened to the admiring husband.
"That is all right," said Inspector Chippenfield soothingly. "I understand your scruples. They do you credit, but an honest man like you doesn't want to shield a criminal from justice, best of all a cold-blooded murderer."
When Rolfe returned to his superior with Evans's signed statement in his hand, he found the inspector preparing to leave the office.
"Put on your hat and come with me," said the inspector. "We will go out and see Mrs. Hill. I'll frighten the truth out of her and then tackle Hill. He is sure to be up at Riversbrook, and we can go there from Camden Town."
While on the way to Camden Town by tube, Inspector Chippenfield arranged his plans with the object of saving time. He would interview Mrs. Hill, and while he was doing so, Rolfe could make inquiries at the neighbouring hotels about Hill. It was the inspector's conviction that a man who had anything to do with the murder would require a steady supply of stimulants next day. Mrs. Hill kept a small confectionery shop adjoining a cinema theatre to supplement her husband's wages by a little earnings of her own in order to support her child. Although the shop was an unpretentious one and catered mainly for the haporth of the juvenile patrons of the picture house next door, it was called the Camden Town Confectionery Emporium, and the title was printed over the little shop in large letters. Inspector Chippenfield walked into the empty shop and rapped sharply on the counter. A little thin woman with prematurely grey hair and a depressed expression appeared from the back in response to the summons. She started nervously as her eye encountered the police uniform, but she waited to be spoken to.
"Is your name Hill?" asked the inspector sternly. "Mrs. Emily Hill?"
The woman nodded feebly, her frightened eyes fixed on the inspector's face.
"Then I want a word with you," continued the inspector, walking through the shop into the parlour. "Come in here and answer my questions."
Mrs. Hill followed him timidly into the room he had entered. It was a small, shabby furnished apartment, and the inspector's massive proportions made it look smaller still. He took up a commanding position on the strip of drugget which did duty as a hearthrug, and staring fiercely at her, suddenly commenced.
"Mrs. Hill, where was your husband on the night of the 18th of August when his employer, Sir Horace Fewbanks, was murdered?"
Mrs. Hill shrank before that fierce gaze and said in a low tone,
"Please, sir, he was at home." "At home, was he? I'm not so sure of that. Tell me all about your husband's movements on that day and night. What time did he come home to begin with?"
"He came home early in the afternoon to take our little girl to the zoo, which was a treat she had been looking forward for a long while. I couldn't go myself, there being the shop to look after, so Mr. Hill and Daphne went to the zoo, and after they came home and had tea, I took her to the pictures, while Mr. Hill minded the shop. It was not the picture palace next door, but the big one in High Street, where they were showing East Lynne. Then when we come home about 10 o'clock, we all had supper and went to bed."
"And your husband didn't go out again?"
"No, sir. When I got up in the morning to bring him a cup of tea, he was still sound asleep."
"But might he not have gone out in the night while you were asleep?"
"No, sir. I'm a very light sleeper, and I awake at the least stir."
Mrs. Hill's story seemed to ring true enough, although she kept her eyes fixed on her interrogator with a kind of frightened brightness. Inspector Chippenfield looked at her in silence for a few seconds.
"So that's the whole truth, is it?" he said at length.
"Yes, sir," the woman earnestly assured him. "You can ask Mr. Hill and he'll tell you the same thing."
Something reminiscent in Inspector Chippenfield's mind responded to this sentence. He pondered over it for a moment and then remembered that Hill had applied the same phrase to his wife. Evidently there had been collusion, a comparing of tales beforehand. The woman had been tutored by her cunning scoundrel of a husband, but undoubtedly her tale was false.
"The whole truth?" said the inspector again.
"Yes, sir," answered Mrs. Hill.
"Now look here," said the police officer in his sternest tones as he shook a warning finger at the little woman. "I know you are lying. I know Hill didn't sleep in the house that night. He was seen near Riversbrook in the early part of the night, and he was seen wandering about Covent Garden after the murder had been committed. It is no use lying to me, Mrs. Hill. If you want to save your husband from being arrested for this murder, you'll tell the truth. What time did he leave here that night?"
"I've already told you the truth, sir," replied the little woman. "He didn't leave the place after he came back from the Zoo."
Inspector Chippenfield was puzzled. It seemed to him that Mrs. Hill was a woman of weak character, and yet she stuck firmly to her story. Perhaps Evans had made a mistake in identifying Hill as the man who had been carried into his bar after being knocked down. Nothing was more common than mistakes of identification. His glance wandered round the room as though in search of some inspiration for his next question. His eye took mechanical note of the trumpery articles of rickety furniture, wandered over the cheap almanac prints which adorned the walls, but became riveted in the cheap overmantel which surmounted the fireplace. For in the slip of mirror which formed the centre of that ornament, Inspector Chippenfield caught the sight of the features of Mrs. Hill frowning and shaking her head at somebody invisible. He turned his head warily, but she was too quick for him, and her features were impassive again when he looked at her. Following the direction indicated by the mirror, Inspector Chippenfield saw Mrs. Hill had been signalling through the window which looked into the backyard. He reached it in a step and threw open the window. A small and not overclean little girl was just leaving the yard by the gate. Inspector Chippenfield called to her pleasantly, and she retraced her steps with a frightened face.
"Come in, my dear. I want you," said the inspector, wreathing his red face into a smile. "I'm fond of little girls."
The little girl smiled, nodded her head, and presently appeared in response to the inspector's invitation. He glanced at Mrs. Hill, noticed that her face was grey and drawn with sudden terror. She opened her mouth as though to speak, but no words came. The inspector lifted the child onto his knee. She nestled to him confidingly enough and looked up into his face with an artless glance. "What is your name, my dear?"
"Daphne, sir. Daphne Hill."
"How old are you, Daphne?"
"Please, sir, I'm 8 next birthday."
"Why, you're quite a big girl, Daphne. Do you go to school?"
"Oh, yes, sir. I'm in the second form."
"Do you like going to school, Daphne?"
"Yes, sir."
"I suppose you like going to the Zoo better. Did you like going with Father the other day?" The child's eyes sparkled with retrospective pleasure.
"Oh, yes," she said delightedly. "We saw all kinds of things, lions and tigers and elephants. I had a ride on an elephant."
Her eyes grew big with a memory.
"And he took a bun with his long nose out of my hand."
"That was splendid, Daphne. Which did you like best, the Zoo or the pictures?"
"I like them both," she replied.
"Was Father at home when you came home from the pictures?"
"No," said the little girl innocently. "He was out."
Mrs. Hill, standing a little way off with fear on her face, uttered an inarticulate noise and took a step towards the inspector and her daughter. "Better not interfere, Mrs. Hill, unless you want to make matters worse," said the inspector meaningly.
"Now tell me, Daphne, dear, when did your father come home?"
"Not till the morning," replied the little girl with a timid glance at her mother.
"How do you know that?"
"Because I slept in mother's bed that night with mother, like I always do when father is away. But father came home in the morning and lifted me into my own bed, because he said he wanted to go to bed."
"What time was that, Daphne?"
"I don't know, sir."
"It was light, Daphne. You could see."
"Oh, yes, sir."
Inspector Chippenfield told the child she was a good girl and gave her sixpence. The little one slipped off his knee and ran across to her mother with delight to show her the coin, all unconscious that she had betrayed her father. The mother pushed the child from her with a heartbroken gesture. A heavy step was heard in the shop, and the inspector, looking through the window, saw Rolfe. He opened the door leading from the shop and beckoned his subordinate in. Rolfe was excited and looked like a man burdened with weighty news. He whispered a word in Inspector Chippenfield's ear. "Let's go into the shop," said Inspector Chippenfield promptly. "But first I'll make things safe here." He locked the door leading to the kitchen, put the key into his pocket, and followed his colleague into the shop. "Now, Rolf, what is it?"
"I've found out that Hill put in nearly the whole day after the murder drinking in a wine tavern. He sat there like a man in a dream and spoke to nobody. The only thing he took any interest in was the evening papers. He bought about a dozen of them during the afternoon."
"Where was this?" asked the inspector.
"At a little wine tavern in High Street, where he's never been seen before. The man who keeps the place gave me a good description of him, though. Hill went there about 10 o'clock in the morning and started drinking port wine, and as fast as the evening papers came out, he sent the boy out for them, glanced through them, and then crumpled them up. He stayed there till after 5 o'clock. By that time the 6:30 editions would reach Camden Town, and if you remember, it was the 6:30 editions which had the first news of the murder. The tavern keeper declares that Hill drank nearly 2 bottles of Tarragona port in threepenny glasses during the day."
"I should have credited Hill with a better taste in port, with his opportunities as Sir Horace Fewbanks' butler," said the Inspector Chippenfield dryly. "What you have found out, Rolf, only goes to bear out my own discovery that Hill is deeply implicated in this affair. I have found out for my part that Hill did not spend the night of the murder at home here." There was a ring of triumph in Inspector Chippenfield's voice as he announced this discovery, but before Rolf could make any comment upon it, there was a quick step behind them, and both men turned to see Hill. The butler was astonished at finding the two police officers in his wife's shop. He hesitated, and apparently his first impulse was to turn into the street again. But realizing the futility of such a course, he came forward with an attempt to smooth his worried face into a conciliatory smile.
"Hill," said Inspector Chippenfield sternly, "once and for all, will you own up where you were on the night of the murder?"
Hill started slightly. Then, with admirable self-command, he recovered himself and became as tight-lipped and reticent as ever.
"I've already told you, sir," he replied smoothly. "I spent it in my own home. If you ask my wife, sir, she'll tell you I never stirred out of the house after I came back from taking my little girl to the zoo."
"I know she will, you scoundrel," burst out the choleric inspector. "She's been well tutored by you, and she tells the tale very well. But it is no good, Hill. You forgot to tutor your little daughter, and she's innocently put you away. What's more, you were seen in London before daybreak the night after the murder. The game's up, my man." Inspector Chippenfield produced a pair of handcuffs as he spoke. Hill passed his tongue over his dry lips before he was able to speak.
"Don't put them on me," he said imploringly as Inspector Chippenfield advanced towards him. I'll confess."
End of chapter 10 of The Hampstead Mystery by John Watson and Arthur Rees. Read by Lars Rolander.
Chapter 11 of The Hampstead Mystery. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Reading by Lars Rolander. The Hampstead Mystery by John Watson and Arthur Rees. Chapter 11. Inspector Chippenfield's first words were a warning. "You know what you are saying, Hill?" he asked. "You know what this means? Any statement you make may be used in evidence against you at your trial." "I'll tell you everything," faltered Hill. The impassive mask of the well-trained English servant had dropped from him, and he stood revealed as a trembling elderly man with furtive eyes and painfully shaken manner. "I'll be glad to tell you everything," he declared, laying a twitching hand on the inspector's coat. "I've not had a minute's peace of rest since it happened." The dry, official manner in which Inspector Chippenfield produced a notebook was in striking contrast to the trapped man's attitude. "Go ahead," he commanded, wetting his pencil between his lips. Before Hill could respond, a small boy entered the shop, a ragged, shock-headed, dirty urchin, bareheaded and barefooted. He tapped loudly on the counter with a halfpenny.
"What do you want, boy?" roughly asked the inspector.
"A pot of black, boys," responded the child in a confident tone of a regular customer.
"If you'll permit me, sir, I'll serve him," said Hill, and he glided behind the little counter, took some black, sticky sweetmeats from one of the glass jars on the shelf and gave them to the boy, who popped one in his mouth and scurried off. "I think we had better go inside and hear what Hill has to say, Inspector, while Mrs. Hill minds the shop," said Rolfe. He had caught a glimpse of Mrs. Hill's white, frightened face peering through the dirty little glass pane in the parlour door. Inspector Chippenfield approved of the idea. "We don't want to spoil your wife's business, Hill. She's likely to need it," he said, with cruel official banter. "Come here, Mrs. Hill," he said, raising his voice. The faded little woman appeared in response to the summons, bringing the child with her. She shot a frightened glance at her husband, which Inspector Chippenfield intercepted. "Never mind looking at your husband, Mrs. Hill," he said roughly. "You've done your best for him, and the only thing to be told now is the truth. Now you and your daughter can stay in the shop. We want your husband inside." Mrs. Hill clasped her hands quickly.
"Oh, what is it, Henry?" she said. "Tell me what has happened. What have they found out?"
"Keep your mouth shut," commanded her husband harshly. "This way, sir, if you please." Inspector Chippenfield and Rolfe followed him into the parlour. "Now, Hill," impatiently said the Inspector Chippenfield. The butler raised his head wearily.
"I suppose I may well begin at the beginning and tell you everything," he said.
"Yes," replied the inspector. "It is not much use keeping anything back now."
"Oh, it's not a case of keeping anything back," replied Hill. "You're too clever for me, and I made up my mind to tell you everything. But I thought I might be able to cut the first part short so as to save your time. But so that you'll understand everything, I've got to go a long way back. Shortly after I entered Sir Horace Fewbanks' service, in fact, I hadn't been long with him before I began to see he was leading a strange life, a double life, if I may say so. A servant in a gentleman's house, particularly one in my position, sees a good deal he's not meant to see. In fact, he couldn't close his eyes to it if he wanted to, as no doubt you, from your experience, sir, know very well. A confidential servant sees and hears a lot of things, sir."
Inspector Chippenfield nodded his head sharply, but he did not speak.
"I think Sir Horace trusted me too," continued Hill humbly, "more than he would have trusted most servants on account of my past. I fancy, if I may say so, that he counted on my gratitude because he had given me a fresh start in life. And he was quite right. At first."
Hill dropped his voice and looked down as he uttered the last two words.
"I'd have done anything for him. But as I was saying, sir, I hadn't been long in his house before I found out that he had a weakness." Hill timidly bowed his head as though apologizing to the dead judge for assailing his character. "A weakness for the ladies. Sometimes Sir Horace went off for the weekend without saying where he was going, and sometimes he went out late at night and didn't return till after breakfast. Then he had ladies visiting him at Riversbrook. Not real ladies, if you understand, sir. Sometimes there was a small party of them, and then they made a noise singing music hall songs and drinking wine, but generally they came alone. Towards the end there was one who came a lot oftener than the others. I found out afterwards that her name was Fanning, Doris Fanning. She was a very pretty young woman, and Sir Horace seemed very fond of her. I knew that because I've heard him talking to her in the library. Sir Horace had a rather loud voice, and I couldn't help overhearing him sometimes when I took things to his rooms. One night, it was before Sir Horace left for Scotland, a rainy, gusty night, this young woman came. I forgot to mention that when Sir Horace expected visitors, he used to tell me to send the servants to bed early. He told me to do so this night, saying as usual, 'You understand, Hill?' And I replied, 'Yes, Sir Horace.' The young woman came about 10:30, and I let her in the side door and showed her up to the library on the first floor, where he used to sit and work and read. Half an hour afterwards, I took up some refreshments, some sandwiches and a small bottle of champagne for the young lady, and then went back downstairs to Sir Horace rang for me to let the lady out, which was generally about midnight. But this night I'd hardly been downstairs more than 1/4 hour when I heard a loud crash, followed by a sort of scream. Before I could get out of my chair to go upstairs, I heard the study door open and Sir Horace called out, 'Hill, come here.' I went upstairs as quick as I could, and the door of the study being wide open, I could see inside. Sir Horace and the young lady had evidently been having a quarrel. They were standing up facing each other, and the table at which they had been sitting was knocked over, and the refreshments I had taken up had been scattered all about. The young woman had been crying. I could see that at a glance, but Sir Horace looked dignified and the perfect gentleman, like he always was. He turned to me when he saw me and said, 'Hill, kindly show this young lady out.' I bowed and waited for her to follow me, which she did after giving Sir Horace an angry look. I let her out the same way as I let her in, and took her through the plantation to the front gate, which I locked after her. When I got inside the house again and was beginning to bolt up things for the night, Sir Horace called me again and I went upstairs. 'Hill,' he said in the same calm and collected voice, 'if that young lady calls again, you are to deny her admittance. That is all, Hill.' And he turned back into his room again. I didn't see her again until the morning after Sir Horace left for Scotland. I had arranged for the female servants to go to Sir Horace's estate in the country during his absence, as he instructed before his departure, and they and I were very busy on this morning getting the house in order to be closed up, putting covers on the furniture and locking up the valuables. It was Sir Horace's custom to have this done when he was away every year, instead of keeping the servants idling about the house on board wages. And the house was then left in my charge, as I told you, sir. And after the servants went to the country, it was my custom to live at home till Sir Horace returned, coming over 2 or 3 times a week to look over the place and make sure that everything was all right. On this morning, sir, after superintending the servants clearing up things, I went outside the house to have a final look round and to see that the locks of the front and back gates were in good working order. I was going to the back first, sir, but happening to glance about me as I walked round the house, I saw the young woman that Sir Horace had ordered me to show out of the house the night before he went to Scotland, peering out from behind one of the fir trees of the plantation in front of the house. As soon as she saw that I saw her, she beckoned to me. I would not have taken any notice of her, only I didn't want the women servants to see her. Sir Horace, I knew, would not have liked that, so I went across to her. I asked her what she wanted, and I told her it was no use her wanting to see Sir Horace, for he had gone to Scotland. "I don't want to see him," she said, as impudent as brass. "It's you I want to see, field or hill or whatever you call yourself now." It gave me quite a turn, I assure you, to find that this young woman knew my secret, and I turned round apprehensive-like to make sure that none of the servants had heard her. She noticed me, and she laughed. "It's all right, Hill," she said. "I'm not going to tell on you. I've just brought you a message from an old friend, Fred Birchill. He wants to see you tonight at this address." And with that she put a bit of paper into my hand. I was so upset and excited that I said I'd be there, and she went away. This Fred Birchill was a man I'd met in prison, and he was in the cell next to me. How he'd got on my tracks I had no idea, but I seemed to see all my new life fall into pieces now he knew. I tried to run straight since I served my sentence, and I knew Sir Horace would stand to me, but he couldn't afford to have any scandal about it. And I knew that if there was any possibility of my past becoming known, I should have to leave his employ. And then there was my poor wife and child and this little business, sir. Nothing was known about my past here, so I determined to go and see this Birchill, sir. The address she had given me was in Westminster, and as my time was practically my own, when Sir Horace wasn't home, I went down that same evening. And when I got up the flight of stairs and knocked at the door, it was a woman's voice that said, 'Come in.' I thought I recognized the voice. When I opened the door, you can imagine my surprise when I saw the young woman to be Doris Fanning, who had had the quarrel with Sir Horace that night and had brought me the note that morning. Birchill was sitting in a corner of the room with his feet on another chair, smoking a pipe. 'Come in, number 21, he says with an unpleasant smile. 'Come in and see an old friend. Put a chair for him, Doris, and leave the room.' The girl did so, and as soon as the door was closed behind her, Birchill turned round to me and burst out, 'Hill, that damned employee of yours has served me a nasty trick, but I'm going to get even with him, and you're going to help me.' I was taken back at his words, but I wanted to hear more before I spoke. Then he told me that the young woman I had seen had been brutally treated by Sir Horace. She had been living in a little flat in Westminster on a monthly allowance which Sir Horace made her, but he'd suddenly cut off her allowance and she'd have to be turned out in the street to starve because she couldn't pay her rent. 'A nice thing,' said Birchill fiercely, 'for this high-placed loose liver to carry on like this with a poor innocent girl whose only fault was that she loved him too well. If I could show him up and pull him down, I would. But I've done time like you, Hill. He was the judge who sentenced me, and if I tried to injure him that way, my word would carry no weight. But I'll put up a job on him that'll make him sorry for the longest day he lives. And you'll help me. Sir Horace is in Scotland, and you're in charge of his place. Get rid of the servants, Hill, and we'll burgle his house. We can easily do it between us.'
At this stage of his narrative, Hill stopped and looked anxiously at his audience, as though to gather some idea of their feelings before he proceeded further. But Inspector Chippenfield, with a fierce stare, merely remarked, 'And you consented?' 'I didn't at first,' Hill retorted earnestly. 'But when I refused, he threatened me.
threatened that he'd expose me and drag me and my wife and child down to poverty. I pleaded with him, but it was of no use, and at last I had to consent. I had some hope that in doing so I might find an opportunity to warn Sir Horace, but Birchill did not give me a chance. He insisted that the burglary should take place without delay. All I was to do was to give him a plan of the house, explain where to find most valuable articles that had been left there, and wait for him at the flat while he committed the burglary. His idea in making me wait for him at the flat was to make sure that I didn't play him false, put the double on him, as he called it, and he told the girl not to let me out of her sight till he came back. If anything went wrong, I should have to pay for it when he came back. In accordance with Sir Horace's instructions, I sent the servants off to his country estate. It had been arranged that Birchill was to wait for me to come over to the flat on the 18th of August, the night fixed for the burglary. But about 7 o'clock, while I was at Riversbrook, I heard the noise of wheels outside, and looking out, I saw to my dismay Sir Horace getting out of a taxicab with a suitcase in his hand. My first impulse was to tell him everything. Indeed, I think that if I had had a chance, I would have. But he came in looking very severe, and without saying a word about why he had returned from Scotland, said very sharply, "Hill, have the servants been sent down to the country, as I directed?" I told him that they had. "Very good," he said. "Then you go away at once. I won't want you any more. I want the house to myself tonight." "Sir Horace," I began, trembling a little, but he stopped me. "Go immediately," he said. "Don't stand there." And he said it in such a tone that I was glad to go. There was something in his look that frightened me that night. I got across to Birchill's place and found him and the girl waiting for me. I told him what had happened and begged him to give up the idea of the burglary. But he'd been drinking heavily and was in a nasty mood. First he said I'd been playing him false and had warned Sir Horace. But when I assured him that I hadn't, he insisted on going to commit the burglary just the same. With that he pulled out a revolver from his pocket and swore with an oath that he'd put a bullet through me when he came back if I'd played him false and put Sir Horace on his guard, and that he'd put a bullet in the old scoundrel, meaning Sir Horace, if he interrupted him while he was robbing the house. He sat there, cursing and drinking till he fell asleep, with his head on the table, snoring. I sat there not daring to breathe, hoping he'd sleep till morning. But Miss Fanning woking up about 9, and he staggered to his feet to get out, with his revolver stuck in his coat pocket. He was away over 3 hours, and the girl and I sat there without saying a word, just looking at each other and waiting for a clock on the mantelpiece to chime the quarters. It was a cuckoo clock, and it had just chimed 12 when we heard a quick step coming upstairs to the flat. The girl fixed her big dark eyes inquiringly on me, and then we heard a hoarse whisper through the keyhole, telling us to open the door. The girl ran to the door and let him in, but she shrieked at the sight of him when she saw him in the light, for he looked ghastly, and there was a spot of blood on his face, and his hands were smeared with it. He was shaking all over, and he went to the whiskey bottle and drained the drop of spirit he'd left in it. Then he turned to us and said, "Sir Horace Fewbanks is dead, murdered." I suppose he read what he saw in our eyes, for he burst out angrily, "Don't stand there staring at me like a pair of damned fools. You don't think I did it. As God's my judge, I never did it. He was dead and stiff when I got there." Then he told us his story of what had happened. He said that when he got to Riversbrook, there was a light in the library, and he got over the fence and hid himself in the garden. Then he noticed that there was a light in the hall, and that the hall door was open. He thought Sir Horace had left it open by mistake, and he was going to creep into the house and hide himself there till after Sir Horace went to bed. But suddenly the light in the library went out, and Birchill again hid behind a tree, for he thought Sir Horace was retiring for the night. Then the light in the hall went out, and immediately after Birchill heard the hall door being closed. Then he heard a step on the gravel path and saw a woman walking quickly down the path to the gate. She was a well-dressed woman, and Birchill naturally thought that she was one of Sir Horace's lady friends, but he thought it odd that Sir Horace, who was always a very polite gentleman to the ladies, should not have shown her off the premises. He waited in the garden about half an hour, and as everything in the house seemed quite still, he made his way to a side window and forced it open. He had an electric torch with him, and he used this to find his way about the house. First of all, he wanted to find out in which room Sir Horace was sleeping, and he knew from the plan he'd made me draw for him which was Sir Horace's bedroom. So he went there and opened the door quietly and listened. But he could not hear anyone breathing. Then he tried some of the other rooms and turned on his torch, but could see no one. He thought that perhaps Sir Horace had fallen asleep in a chair in the library, and he went there. He listened at the door, but could hear no sound. Then he turned on his torch, and by its light he saw a dreadful sight. Sir Horace was lying huddled up near the desk, dead, just dead, he thought, because there were little bubbles of blood on his lips as if they had been blown there when breathing his last. He didn't wait to see any more, but he turned and ran out of the house. I didn't believe his story, though Miss Fanning did, but he stuck to it and seemed so frightened that I thought there might be something in it till he brought out that he'd lost his revolver somewhere. Then I remember the horrid threats he used against Sir Horace, and I was convinced that he had committed the murder. But of course I dared not let him think I suspected him, and I pretended to console him. But the feeling that kept running through my head was that both of us would be suspected of the murder. I told this to Birchill, and that frightened him still more. "What are we to do?" he kept saying. "We shall both be hanged." Then after a while we recovered ourselves a bit and began to look at it from a more common sense point of view. Nobody knew about Birch's visit to the house except our two selves and the girl, and there was no reason why anybody should suspect us as long as we kept that knowledge to ourselves. Birch's idea after we talked this over was that I should go quietly home to bed and pay a visit to Riversbrook on Friday as usual, discover Sir Horace Fewbanks' body, and then tell the police. But I didn't like to do that for two reasons. I didn't think that my nerves would be in a fit state to tell the police how I found the body without betraying to them that I knew something about it. And I couldn't bear to think of Sir Horace's body lying neglected all alone in that empty house till the following day, though I kept that reason to myself. It was the girl who hit on the idea of sending a letter to the police. She said that it would be the best thing to do, because if they were informed and went to the house and discovered the body, it wouldn't be so difficult for me to face them afterwards. I agreed to that, and so did Birchill, who was very frightened in case I might give anything away, and consented on that account. The girl showed us how to write the letter too. She said she'd often heard of anonymous letters being written that way, and she brought out three different pens and a bottle of ink and a writing pad. After we'd agreed to write, she showed us how to do it, each one printing a letter on the paper in turn and using a different pen each time.
"You took care to leave no fingerprints," said Inspector Chippenfield.
"We used a handkerchief to wrap our hands in," said Hill. "Birchill got tired of passing the paper from one to another and wrote all his letters, leaving spaces for the girl and me to write in ours. When the letter was written, we wrote the address on the envelope the same way and stamped it. Then I went out and posted the letter in a pillar box."
"At Covent Garden?" suggested Inspector Chippenfield.
"Yes, at Covent Garden," said Hill. "When I got home, my wife was awake and in a terrible fright. She wanted to know what I'd been, but I didn't tell her. I told her, though, that my very life depended on nobody knowing I'd been out of my own home that night, and I made her swear that no matter who questioned her, she'd stick to the story that I'd been at home all night and in bed. She begged me to tell her why, and as I knew that she'd have to be told the next day, I told her that Sir Horace Fewbanks had been murdered. She buried her face in her pillow with a moan. But when I took an oath that I had had no hand in it, she recovered and promised not to tell a living soul that I had been out of the house, and I knew I could depend on her. Next morning, as soon as I got up, I hurried off to a little wine tavern and asked to see the morning papers. It was a foolish thing to do, because I might have known that nothing could have been discovered in time to get into the morning papers, for I hadn't posted the letter until nearly four o'clock. But I was all nervous and upset, and as I couldn't face my wife or settle to anything until I knew the police had got the letter and found the body, I, though a strictly temperate man in the ordinary course of life, sir, sat down in one of the little compartments of the place and ordered a glass of wine to pass the time till the first editions of the evening papers came out. They are usually here about noon, but there was no news in the first editions, and so I stayed there drinking port wine and buying the papers as fast as they came out. But it was not till the 6:30 editions came out, late in the afternoon, that the papers had news. I hurried home then and went up to Riversbrook and reported myself to you, sir. As Hill finished his story, he buried his face in his hands and bowed his head on the table in an attitude of utter dejection. Rolfe, looking at him, wondered if he were acting a part, or if he had really told the truth. He looked at Inspector Chippenfield to see how he regarded the confession, but his superior officer was busily writing in his notebook. In a few moments, however, he put the pocketbook down on the table and turned to the butler. "Sit up, man," he commanded sternly. "I want to ask you some questions." Hill raised a haggard face. "Yes, sir," he said, with what seemed to be a painful effort. "What is this girl Fanning like?" "Rather a showy piece of goods, if I may say so, sir. She has big black eyes and black hair and small regular teeth."
"And Sir Horace had been keeping her?"
"I think so, sir."
"And a fortnight before Sir Horace left for Scotland, there was a quarrel? Sir Horace cast her off?"
"That is what it looked like to me," said the butler.
"What was the cause of the quarrel?"
"That I don't know, sir."
"Didn't Birchill tell you?"
"Well, not in so many words. But I gathered from things he dropped that Sir Horace had found out that he was a friend of Miss Fanning's and didn't like it."
"Naturally," said the philosophic police official. "Is Birchill still at this flat, and is the girl still there?"
"The last I heard of them, they were, sir. Of course, they had been talking of moving after Sir Horace stopped all the allowance."
"Well, Hill, I'll investigate this story of yours," said the inspector, as he rose to his feet and placed his notebook in his pocket. "If it is true, if you have given us all the assistance in your power and have kept nothing back, I'll do my best for you. Of course, you realise that you are in a very serious position. I don't want to arrest you unless I have to, but I must detain you while I investigate what you have told us. You will come up with us to the Camden Town Station, and then your statement will be taken down fully. I'll give you 3 minutes in which to explain things to your wife." End of chapter 11 of the Hampstead Mystery. by John Watson and Arthur Rees. Read by Lars Rolander.
Chapter 12 of The Hampstead Mystery. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Reading by Lars Rolander. The Hampstead Mystery by John Watson and Arthur Rees. Chapter 12.
"Do you think Hill's story is true?" Rolfe asked Inspector Chippenfield as they left Camden Town Police Station and turned in the direction of the Tube Station.
"We'll soon find out," replied the inspector. "Of course, there is something in it, but there is no doubt Hill will not stick at a lie to save his own skin. But we are more likely to get at the truth by threatening to arrest him than by arresting him. If he were arrested, he would probably shut up and say no more."
"And are you going to arrest Birchill?"
"Yes."
"For the murder?" asked Rolfe.
"No, for burglary. It would be a mistake to charge him with murder until we get more evidence. The papers would jeer at us if we charged him with murder and then dropped the charge."
"Do you think Birchill will squeak?"
"On Hill?" said the inspector. "When he knows that Hill has been trying to fit him for the murder, he'll try to do as much for Hill. And between them, we'll come at the truth. We are on the right track at last, my boy. And thank God, we have beaten our friend Crewe."
Inspector Chippenfield's satisfaction in his impending triumph over Crewe was increased by a chance meeting with the detective. As the two police officials came out of Leicester Square Station on their way to Scotland Yard to obtain a warrant for Birchill's arrest, they saw Crewe in a taxi cab. Crewe also saw them, and telling the driver to pull up, leaned out of the window and looked back at the two detectives. When they came up with the taxicab, they saw that Crewe had on a light overcoat and that there was a suitcase beside the driver. Crewe was going on a journey of some kind.
"Anything fresh about the Riverbrook case?" he asked.
"No, nothing fresh," replied Inspector Chippenfield, looking Crewe straight in the face.
"You are a long time in making an arrest," said Crewe in a bantering tone.
"We want to arrest the right man," was the reply. "There is nothing like getting the right man to start with. It saves such a lot of time and trouble. Where are you off to?"
"I'm taking a run down to Scotland."
The inspector glanced at Crewe rather enviously.
"You are fortunate in being able to enjoy yourself just now," he said meaningly. "I won't drop work altogether," remarked Crewe. "I'll make a few inquiries there."
"About the Riversbrook affair?"
"Yes."
With the murderer practically arrested, Inspector Chippenfield permitted himself the luxury of smiling at the way in which Crewe was following up a false scent.
"I thought the murder was committed in London, not in Scotland," he said.
"Wrong, Chippenfield," said Crewe with a smile. "Sir Horace was murdered in Scotland, and his body was brought up to London by train and placed in his own house in order to mislead the police. Goodbye."
As the taxicab drove off, Inspector Chippenfield turned to his subordinate and said,
"We'll rub it into him when he comes back and finds that we've got our man under lock and key. He's on some wild goose chase. Scotland. He might as well go to Siberia while he's about it."
With a warrant in his pocket, Inspector Chippenfield, accompanied by Rolfe, set out for Macaulay Mansions, Westminster. They found the mansions to be situated in a quiet and superior part of Westminster, not far from Victoria Station, and consisting of a large block of flats overlooking a square, a pocket handkerchief patch of green, which was supposed to serve as breathing space for the flats which surrounded it. Macaulay Mansions had no lift, and number 43, the scene of the events of Hill's confession, was on the top floor. Inspector Chippenfield and Rolfe mounted the stairs steadily, and finally found themselves standing on a neat coconut doormat outside the door of number 43. The door was closed. "Well, well," said the inspector as he paused panting on the doormat and rang the bell. "Snug quarters, these, very snug. Strange that these sort of women never know enough to run straight when they are well off." The door opened and a young woman confronted them. She was hardly more than a girl, pretty and refined looking, with large dark eyes, a pathetic drooping mouth, and a wistful expression. She wore a well-made indoor dress of soft satin without ornaments, and her luxuriant dark hair was simply and becomingly coiled at the back of her head. She held a book in her left hand, with one finger between the leaves, as though the summons to the door had interrupted her reading, and glanced inquiringly at the visitors, waiting for them to intimate their business. She was so different from the type of girl they had expected to see that Inspector Chippenfield had some difficulty in announcing it. "Are you Miss Fanning?" he asked. "Yes," she replied. "Then you are the young woman we wish to see, and with your permission we'll come inside," said Inspector Chippenfield, recovering from his first surprise and speaking briskly. They followed the girl into the hall, and into a room off the hall to which she led the way. A small Pomeranian dog, which lay on an easy chair, sprang up barking shrilly at their entrance, but at the command of the girl it settled down on its silk cushion again. The apartment was a small sitting room, daintily furnished in excellent feminine taste. Both police officers took in the contents of the room with a glance of trained observers, and both noticed that, prominent among the ornaments on the mantelpiece, stood a photograph of the late Sir Horace Fewbanks in a handsome silver frame. The photograph made it easy for Inspector Chippenfield to enter upon the object of the visit of himself and his subordinate to the flat. "I see you have a photograph of Sir Horace Fewbanks there," he said in what he intended to be an easy conversational tone, waving his hand towards the mantelpiece. The wistful expression of the girl's face deepened as she followed his glance. "Yes," she said simply, "it is so terrible about him." "Was he a relative of yours?" asked the inspector. She had come to the conclusion they were police officers, and that they were aware of the position she occupied. "He was very kind to me," she replied. "When did you see him last? How long before he died?" "Are you detectives?" she asked. "From Scotland Yard," replied Inspector Chippenfield with a bow. "Why have you come here? Do you think that I know anything about the murder?"
"Not in the least." The inspector's tone was reassuring. "We merely want information about Sir Horace's movements prior to his departure for Scotland. When did you see him last?"
"I don't remember," she said after a pause.
"You must try," said the inspector in a tone which contained a suggestion of command.
"Oh, a few days before he went away." "A few days?" repeated the inspector. "And you parted on good terms?"
"Yes, on very good terms."
She met his glance frankly. Inspector Chippenfield was silent for a moment. Then, fixing his fiercest stare on the girl, he remarked abruptly, "Where's Birchill?"
"Birchill?"
She endeavoured to appear surprised, but her sudden pallor betrayed her inward anxiety at the question.
I don't know what you mean."
"I mean the man you've been keeping with Sir Horace Fewbanks' money," said the inspector brutally.
"I've been keeping nobody with Sir Horace Fewbanks' money," protested the girl feebly. "It's cruel of you to insult me."
"That'll about do to go on with," said Inspector Chippenfield with a sudden change of tone, rising to his feet as he spoke. "Rolfe, keep an eye on her while I search the flat." Rolfe crossed over from where he had been sitting and stood beside the girl. She glanced up at him wildly, with terror dawning in the depth of her dark eyes.
"What do you mean? How dare you?"
she cried in an effort to be indignant. "Now, don't try your tragedy airs on us," said the inspector. "We've no time for them. If you won't tell the truth, you had better say nothing at all." He plunged his hand into a jardiniere and withdrew a briarwood pipe. "This looks to me like Birchill's property. Keep that dog back, Rolfe." The little dog had sprung off his cushion and was eagerly following the inspector out of the room. Rolfe caught up the animal in his arms and returned to where the girl was sitting. Her face was white and strained, and her big dark eyes followed Inspector Chippenfield, but she did not speak. The inspector tramped noisily into the little hall, leaving the door of the room wide open. Rolfe and the girl saw him fling open the door of another room, a bedroom, and stride into it. He came out again shortly and went down the hall to the rear of the flat. A few minutes later he came back to the room where he had left Rolfe and the girl. His knees were dusty, and some feathers were adhering to his jacket, as though he had been plunging in odd nooks and corners and beneath beds. He was hot, flurried, and out of temper. "The bird's flown," were his first words addressed to Rolfe. "I've hunted high and low, but I cannot find a sign of him. It beats me how he's managed it. He couldn't have gone out the front way without my seeing him go past the door, and the back windows are 4 stories high from the ground."
"Perhaps he wasn't here when we came in," suggested Rolfe.
"Oh, yes, he was. Why, he'd been smoking that pipe in this very room. She was clever enough to open the window to let out the tobacco smoke before she let us in. But she didn't hide the pipe properly, for I saw the smoke from it coming out of the jardiniere. And when I put my hand on the bowl, it was hot. Feel it now." Rolfe placed his hand on the pipe, which Inspector Chippenfield had deposited on the table. The bowl was still warm, indicating that the pipe had recently been alight.
"He must have been smoking the pipe when we knocked at the door and dashed away to hide before she let us in," grumbled the inspector.
"But the question is, where can he have got to? I've hunted everywhere and there's no way out except by the front door so far as I can see. Go and have a look yourself, Rolfe, and see if you can find a trace of him. I'll watch the girl."
Rolfe put down the little dog he had been holding and went out into the hall. The dog accompanied him, frisking about him in a friendly fashion. Rolfe first examined the bedroom that he had seen Inspector Chippenfield enter. It was a small room containing a double bed. It was prettily furnished in white, with white curtains and toilet table articles in ivory to match. A glance round the room convinced Rolfe that it was impossible for a man to secrete himself in it. The door of the wardrobe had been flung open by the inspector,
and the dresses and other articles of feminine apparel it contained flung out on the floor. There was no other hiding place possible, except beneath the bed, and the ruthless hand of the inspector had torn off the white muslin bed hangings, revealing emptiness underneath. Rolfe went out into the hall again and entered the room next the bedroom. This apartment was apparently used as a dining room, for it contained a large table, a few chairs, a small sideboard, a spirit stand, a case of books and ornaments, and two small oak presses. Plainly, there was no place in it where a man could hide himself. The next room was the bathroom, which was also empty. Opposite the bathroom was a small bedroom, very barely furnished, offering no possibility of concealment. Then the passage opened into a large, roomy kitchen, the full width of the rooms on both sides of the hall, and the kitchen completed the flat. Rolfe glanced keenly around the kitchen. There were no cooking appliances visible, or pots or pans, but there was much lumber and odds and ends as though the place were used as a storeroom. Presumably, Miss Fanning obtained her meals from the restaurant on the ground floor of the mansions and had no use for a kitchen. The room was dirty and dusty and crowded with all kinds of rubbish. But the miscellaneous rubbish stored in the room offered no hiding place for a man. Rolfe nevertheless made a conscientious search, shifting the lumber about and ferreting into dark corners without result. Finally, he crossed the room to look out of the window, which had been left open, no doubt, by Inspector Chippenfield. The mansions in which the flat was situated formed part of a large building with back windows overlooking a small piece of ground. The flat was on the fourth story. Rolfe looked around the neighbouring roofs and down onto the ground 50 feet below, but could see nothing. He withdrew his head and was turning to leave the room when his attention was attracted by the peculiar behaviour of the dog, which had followed him throughout on his search. The little animal, after sniffing about the floor, ran to the open window and started whining and jumping up at it. Rolfe quickly returned to the window and looked out. "Why, of course," he muttered. "How could I have overlooked it? Inspector," he called aloud, "come here." Inspector Chippenfield appeared in the kitchen in a state of some excitement at the summons. He carried the key of the front room in his hand, having taken the precaution to lock Miss Fanning in before he responded to the call of his colleague. "What is it, Rolfe?" he asked eagerly. "This dog has tracked him to the window, so he's evidently escaped that way," explained Rolfe briefly. "He's climbed along the window ledge." Inspector Chippenfield approached the window and looked out. A broad window ledge immediately beneath the window ran the whole length of the building beneath the windows on the fourth floor, and so far as could be seen, continued round the side of the house. It was a dizzy, but not a difficult feat for a man of cool head to walk along the ledge to the corner of the house. "I wonder where that infernal ledge goes to," said Inspector Chippenfield, vainly twisting his neck and protruding his body through the window to a dangerous extent to see round the corner of the building. "I dare say it leads to the water pipe, and the scoundrel, knowing that, has been able to get round, shin down, and get clear away." "I'll soon find out," said Rolfe. "I'll walk along to the corner and see."
"Do you think you can do it, Rolfe?" asked the inspector nervously.
"If you fell," he glanced down to the ground far below with a shudder.
"Nonsense," laughed Rolfe. "I won't fall. Why, the ledge is a foot broad, and I've got a steady head. He may not have got very far after all, and I may be able to see him from the corner."
He got out of the window as he spoke and started to walk carefully along the ledge towards the corner of the building. He He reached it safely, peered round, screwed himself round sharply, and came back to the open window, almost at a run. "You're right," he gasped as he sprang through. "I saw him. He is climbing down the spouting, using the chimney brickwork as a brace for his feet. If we get downstairs, we may catch him."
He was out of the kitchen in an instant, up the passage and racing down the steps at a time before the inspector had recovered from his surprise. Then he followed as quickly as he could, but Rolfe had a long start of him. When Inspector Chippenfield reached the ground floor, Rolfe was nowhere in sight. The inspector looked up and down the street, wondering what had become of him. At that instant, a tall young man, bareheaded and coatless, came running out of an alleyway, pursued by Rolfe.
"Stop him!"
cried Rolfe to his superior officer. Inspector Chippenfield stepped quickly out into the street in front of the fugitive. The young man cannoned into the burly officer before he could stop himself, and the inspector clutched him fast. He attempted to wrench himself free, but Rolfe had rushed to his superior's assistance and drew the baton with which he had provided himself when he set out from Scotland Yard.
"You needn't bother about using that thing," said the young man contemptuously. "I'm not a fool. I realise you've got me."
"We'll not give you another chance," Inspector Chippenfield dexterously snapped a pair of handcuffs on the young man's wrist.
"What are these for?" said the captive, regarding them sullenly.
"You'll know soon enough when we get you upstairs," replied the inspector. "Now then, up you go." They reascended the stairs in silence, Inspector Chippenfield and Rolfe walking on each side of their prisoner, holding him by the arms in case he tried to make another bolt. They reached the flat and found the front door open as they had left it. The inspector entered the hall and unlocked the drawing room door. The girl was sitting on the chair where they had left her, with her head bowed down in an attitude of the deepest dejection. She straightened herself suddenly as they entered, and launched a terrified glance at the young man.
"Oh, Fred!" she gasped.
"They were too good for me, Doris," he responded, as though in reply to her unspoken query. "I would have got away from this chap." He indicated Rolfe with a nod of his head. "But I ran into the other one." He stooped as he spoke to brush with his manacled hands some of the dirt from his clothes, which he had doubtless gained in his perilous climb down the side of the house, and then straightened himself to look loweringly at his captors. He was a tall, slender young fellow of about 25 or 26, clean-shaven, with a fresh complexion and a rather effeminate air. He was well-dressed in a grey lounge suit, a soft shirt with a high double collar and silk necktie. He looked, as he stood there, more like a dandified city clerk than the desperate criminal suggested by Hill's confession.
"Come on, what's the charge?"
he demanded insolently, with a slight glance at his manacled hands.
"Is your name Frederick Birchill?" asked Inspector Chippenfield.
The young man nodded.
"Then, Frederick Birchill, you're charged with burglariously entering the house of Sir Horace Fewbanks at Hampstead on the night of the 18th of August."
"Burglary?" said Birchill.
"Anything else?"
"That will do for the present," replied the inspector. "We may find it necessary to charge you with a more serious crime later."
"Well, all I can say is that you've got the wrong man. But that is nothing new for you chaps," he added with a sneer.
"Surely you're not going to charge him with the murder?" said the girl imploringly. The inspector's reply was merely to warn the prisoner that anything he said might be used in evidence against him at his trial.
"He had nothing whatever to do with it. "He knows nothing about it," protested the girl. "If you let him go, I'll tell you who murdered Sir Horace."
"Who murdered him?" asked the inspector. "Hill," was the reply.
End of chapter 12 of The Hampstead Mystery by John Watson and Arthur Rees. Read by Lars Rolander.